Now, you know, years ago, you would watch mass production being done in an automobile factory by robots, machines. Not the kind of machines we think about today, but in those days, they were machines, and they still do. As a matter of fact, they're pretty prevalent in the manufacturing process. But what's the future going to look like, and how far out is it where machines truly take the place of us? In a moment, Life on Nubis. Robert Harkin joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you about Robert Harkin, author of Life on Nubis, also Snowfalling. Now, machines taking over the planet. Like so many people, he walked through a winding path searching for that fulfillment in life. He now develops technology business strategies from one of the largest technology companies in the world. He knows the impact on people when they labor at an ill-suited career and what that does, and he has witnessed the energy and joy experienced by people who are doing what they want to do. Robert Harkin on Coast to Coast. Hey, Robert, how are you?
Hi, George. I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Life on Nubis. Tell me about that title, by the way.
So Nubis is the name of the planet that the colonists have traveled to. And it's about their struggles to survive on the planet and to search for fulfillment in their lives.
Now, you know, we've been watching machines slowly taking over in industry. They're doing all kinds of things. I had a friend of mine who sold his business. They used to manufacture, Robert, prescription pills. But, I mean, what they did is they made the mold that made the pills. And he sold that business. He did very well with it. But it was all machine-driven. I mean, the machine did it all. You know, they'd have one guy on the line just kind of like maintaining it. Now these machines have really gotten sophisticated. What has fueled that? What has gotten the machines to the point where they're at now? Was it the computer?
Well, it's really advances in several different areas of technology. In particular, the computer is playing a big part of it. And we call robotics a big part of it. And by robotics, I don't mean just the gears and wires that we think of when we think of a robot. I also refer to the software intelligence that enables the machine to think or process logic. And there are advances in nanotechnology as well, which nanotechnology deals with the very small, think atoms and molecules, and that's creating amazing advances that are powering both computers and everyday products, but also helping us reach the next level that will ultimately enable machines to replace humans in many forms, if not most forms of work. But we're going to need to understand more about biotechnology as well to really understand how the human mind works so that we can replicate that level of intelligence, which we call general intelligence. And computers have not achieved that yet, but that's going to be the turning point where machines are really able to do everything that humans can do. And we call that point the technological singularity.
Well, I thought of you, Robert, today when the president announced a $100 million project to probe and investigate the brain, how it works, how it functions. As some say, primarily they're trying to do it so they can, you know, knock out Alzheimer's disease and epilepsy. But I was thinking about, you know, this, that if science can learn more about how the brain functions, how the brain works, what it does, could they then not be able to apply it into these machines?
You're spot on. That's exactly right. And the program that President Obama announced is really going to map the neurons, the brain cells in our minds, and the connections to understand how our memories are represented, how we reason, and ultimately what's the source of consciousness. And this is really a companion project with a similar brain research effort going on in the European Union, where they're going to take brain information and try to simulate it within a computer. So it'll be a virtual mind. Jeez. And these two projects together will lay the foundation for understanding how the human mind works and replicating it in an artificial context.
Will we ever get to the point where this computerized mind literally takes over and we become the slave?
Well, I think, you know, the point to get to a point where a computer takes over, we have to understand what that means. What does the computer have to achieve? Because there's a monumental task ahead of us. And, you know, the first thing is to understand what general intelligence is. Yeah. You know, it's the ability to exercise judgment, to have feeling, to have consciousness, to be self-aware, to process things logically. It's also the ability to sense sensory input and to control movement. And the computers are a far cry from that today. And there's a monumental task. You know, in the human brain, there's 86 billion to 100 billion neurons or brain cells. And to put that into context, there's about 7 billion people on the earth. So the brain cells in a single human being are equivalent to the entire human population of 14 Earths. And each of those brain cells has about 1,000 to 10,000 connections with other brain cells within the brain. So we'd have to understand that entire mass is called the connectome to be able to replicate a machine that can think on parity with humans.
Will it show emotion, Robert?
It will. In fact, some researchers announced recently a software program that is able to display human emotions on a face on the screen. And it displayed those human emotions so realistically that people comparing that computer image with the actual actor it was modeled after more accurately described the emotion that the computer displayed than the real person, which is an amazing feat. But you got to understand that the computer is basically faking it at this point. It doesn't understand what it's feeling. It doesn't feel anything. It doesn't have a sense of intensity or what the feeling means. But we're getting to a point where there's discrete aspects of human behavior that can be modeled or faked very realistically.
Will it show empathy, compassion?
Yeah, I think my own speculation is that it will not, you know, because these computers will be logic-based beings, and they won't have the same emotional framework that human beings have because they don't have the biochemical pathways that allow emotions to form. It's not just, you know, the network wiring in the brain. There's a lot more to emotions and relating to other people in humans. And so I think that'll be lacking in these artificial intelligence life forms. If you remember the movie Blade Runner.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the big test was the empathy test. And the androids could not pass the empathy test. But in other aspects, they were completely identical to humans. And I think we'll see something similar to that. Emotions might be fake for a while, but true feelings, true empathy will be at a loss for them.
Well, you know, because, you know, a human being will use that empathy, that caring. It may or may not affect their decision making in the right way. I mean, there are times I'm sure people have made decisions from the heart and not the head, and it screwed them up. I would guess machines would simply do it from the so-called head. They would not have that emotional heart to get involved in anything.
I think that's right. And that's going to create problems interacting with people because people aren't completely logic-based. I mean, we do make logical decisions, but as you mentioned, you know, we do make also decisions from the heart, and those can be good decisions, although sometimes they can have poor outcomes. But, you know, we have a sense of altruism that would be difficult for a computer to replicate. But, you know, part of this, the second half of the question you asked was, you know, will we become slaves to the machines? And there's a lot in there, and it speaks to how we're going to interact with these sentient artificial life forms once they evolve, which is not too many decades away, actually. And, you know, there's a number of possible outcomes. And first, you know, let's lay out what types of beings we'll be dealing with.
Okay.
So the first type is the organic humans, what people as we are today, okay? So they'll exist after technological singularity. Then we'll have enhanced humans. These are people that are genetically modified to increase their intelligence, their physical performance, you know, strength, stamina, agility, you know, enhance their appearance. And there's a lot of medicine and technology we can talk about how that will be achieved. But that's the second type. The third type will be a digital form of human existence. Okay, so a person's brain is scanned and all the patterns and network wiring that are in their brain will be uploaded to a computer architecture.
Could it literally be you in a computer?
Yeah.
You know, almost as if when you turn it on, you can, it's almost like you're in a computer.
Exactly. That's exactly what it'll be like, because there will be architecture that can replicate human thought and the structure of our memories and the logic and the reasoning. And so it will very much be that. And if you are uploaded, you will have trouble distinguishing between whether you're actually the computer or the real person. Because
that's amazing.
You know, yeah. And at that time, there'll be much better mechanical means of conveying sensory input, you know, the visual, the hearing, the taste, the touch, you know, that will really mimic the human body much more accurately. And so that'll be the third form of existence after the technological singularity. And the fourth form is the digital artificial life forms, the pure computers that gained consciousness but didn't exist as a person before that. So the last two, the digital humans and the artificial life forms, will have an incredible ability to evolve very rapidly and have an ability to transcend the organic humans' intelligence.
Well, you know, I love to use the example of the late baseball great for the Boston Red Sox, Ted Williams. He died. They put him in a cryogenic chamber, and then they decided, this is what we're going to do. They severed his head. They kept his head. His head is in a cryogenic chamber, so his brain is intact. What they have always wanted to do, very strange, is clone his body one day and then download the memory from the frozen brain into this cloned body. And hence, Ted Williams literally lives forever. And then, you know, let's say he's sick again and he's 85 years old. You clone a new body, you download the memory, and there you are again. It goes on and on and on. Is that conceivable?
It is, actually. You know, on March 25th, the Wall Street Journal ran an article about regenerative medicine. And it was talking about early efforts to grow body parts using an individual's real cells. And they've accomplished this. They've grown bladders, they've grown windpipes, they've grown blood vessels, they're working on a human heart, they've grown ears, they're growing skin. So we have the technology today, and it's not, you know, commercialized yet. It's still in the experimental phase, but we have the technology to grow human body parts that are from the original person. So you don't need drugs to prevent rejection of an organ transplant like you do today if you get someone else donating an organ to save your life. These are your actual cells and your actual body part. So it doesn't take much more to understand that, hey, if we can do this with one part, we can do it with all the parts, and we can grow a whole new body for this person. And if we understand how to replicate the brain patterns, because we've studied all the connections, then the next part is growing brain cells. And it actually recently there was a scientific announcement that has been achieved. They implanted skin cells into the brain of an animal, and they converted those skin cells into brain cells, human brain cells. So now you have the ability to start creating the pathways in the human brain that will replicate the memories and the personality of the person who's died or is near death.
Isn't that amazing?
It is incredible.
I mean, the things that they're going to be able to do. You know, I've always wondered, I mean, here we are as human beings occupying these shells of bodies that we have. You know, you got your legs, your arms, and everything else. But the true self is your consciousness, your brain power that comes with that. If you were able to just take that and move it to any body, any physical body, I mean, there you are, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it really becomes a form of eternal life. You think about, you know, well, gosh, I wish I could live to 100. Think of all the things I would see. Okay, well, how about 1,000 or 10,000 years old? You know, it's hard to even conceive on that scale, but you can, with regenerative medicine, keep your physical body. You don't even have to upload it to a computer. It's just a constant recycling and replacement. And so, you know, those are some amazing advances, and they bring up a lot of implications about how we live and what our society will be like in the future.
Well, it's amazing technology. Where does this get used during warfare?
That's a great question. So, you know, technology is a tool, and it can be used for peaceful purposes or military purposes. And so when you look at the genetic enhancements that can be done on the physical body, you can look at, you know, stronger muscles and tendons for more power. You can have greater stamina. There was an announcement actually just last Friday that was pretty incredible, and it was the bioengineers have developed the ability to use a human cell as a biological computer. And so they've got all three parts of the computing worked out now: the storage, the transmission, and the logic operations on information within a living cell. And they use non-lethal viruses to achieve this. So what does that mean? That means that, for example, our fat cells, which normally do nothing but store energy, could also be calculating differential equations and providing the answers to our brains. They could be acting as an emergency backup. So if there was a head injury, say a bullet wound to the brain, these cells could take over and keep our heart beating until doctors could cure the head injury. And so it makes, you know, the concept of the super soldier much more feasible and realistic. Now, I'm talking about advances that are in the basic science stage. So to actually apply it to a battlefield context would take more years of development. And that's just looking at the flesh and blood. If you look at the artificial intelligence and the application of robotic technology to military use, there's many possible advances there. You know, last week, engineers at Virginia Tech announced the second prototype of a robotic jellyfish. And this thing is about the size of a man. It weighs 170 pounds, and it's about...
And it has all these tentacles, right?
Yeah, it actually didn't have tentacles in the picture I saw. They had constructed the body, but you could easily attach tentacles for various use. For example, if the tentacles had a way of injecting lethal poison, then you could send the robotic jellyfish against soldiers in the water. You know, but this could also be used for peaceful purposes, obviously, for monitoring ocean pollution and fish populations and things like that.
Going places where man doesn't want to go, maybe.
Exactly.
That's exciting. Robert, stay with us. We're going to talk a little bit more about your work, life on Anubis, space travel, and colonizing when we come back as well, right here on Coast to Coast AM. So pleased to tell you still about our television program, Beyond Belief, which you can watch. It's an internet-based show, but it's taking the planet by storm, and you can take advantage of it 10 days free. Simply go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, click hosts, and the TV icon opens up. Or remember this link, gaiamtv.com/George, gaiamtv.com/George. Also, though, in this 10-day free trial, take advantage and look at all the videos that are available, too. It is really something you're going to like. Welcome back. Robert Harkin with us as we talk about his work, Life on Anubis, of course, and space and colonization we'll talk about in just a second. Robert, of course, this is a novel, but it's well-received. It's a great sci-fi clip like that. How did you decide to write this?
So my motivation actually arose from a trip to school one morning, driving my daughter to start the day. And she asked me what she should do with her life. And after 5 minutes of stumbling through my hard-learned lessons, all I managed to elicit from her was a blank stare. So I decided that I needed to up my parenting, and the novel was a good format to do that, because there's going to be so much change coming down the pike that she's going to have to deal with. And I wanted to be able to capture that, and science fiction really fit the bill quite nicely.
Sure does. Space, time travel, what do you think?
So I think it will be feasible in the future. I mean, it's not possible now to travel, for humans to travel interstellarly, but the technology is being laid there. And, you know, if you look to science fiction as a predictor, it's a good roadmap, because we've seen a lot of science fiction, you know, prophecies or predictions, as you will, come true. You know, the communicator on Star Trek has become the mobile phone. The multi-sensor tricorder device, we have a guy made one of those a couple months ago. But so what does science fiction say about space travel? Well, they have had faster than light travel with warp speed in Star Trek. We've had the colony ship, where it takes generations of people to travel to a distant planet. So the people that started the trip are the ancestors of the people that actually arrived. We've got teleportation. You might recall the transporters in Star Trek. And we've got hyperspace. So there's basic science research going on in some of these areas that suggests that some of these forms of space travel actually might be feasible in the not-too-distant future. We're talking a couple of decades from now. And let's take some of the more feasible versions first. So if we look at a slower than light speed travel, how would we accomplish that? I mean, space is a very difficult place to travel in, because there's great distances, and we want to make this relevant to ourselves. We want to go fast enough to get there while we're still living. But there's environmental issues with radiation and having enough food and water and oxygen and so forth, and also understanding whether we can even live on the planet we arrive at. And a lot of unknowns, too. I mean, it's taken 35 years for Voyager 1 to enter interstellar space, and it just did this back on March 20th. And so we're starting to get more data about what it means to travel between the stars. And one way we might achieve that is using suspended animation. You would refer to the cryonics freezing of the baseball player. Well, that's one possible approach, and that process and the viability of human tissues has been established. In fact, doctors use it every day in infertility treatments, freezing human eggs and human sperm. So we know that we can flash freeze cells and revive them, and they're still living and viable. What's a little bit more problematic is freezing an entire body, and it's not just because it takes a long time. There's can be cellular damage that needs to be repaired.
That's right.
And we have technology emerging to create nanobots, you know, tiny robots the size of red blood cells that can go within our bodies and repair the micro damage that occurs to the tissues from ice crystals forming in our bodies.
And then how do they leave, or do they stay?
Well, ideally, they could stay and monitor the general health of your body and act as a second immune system. But they could also be excreted or removed, you know, through your sweat glands. I mean, there's a number of ways of playing that out, but I envision that we would probably want those nanobots to stay within our bodies. The big challenge with suspended animation that we have today, the technical challenge, is revival after long periods of clinical death. And researchers are working on this. In fact, you had a guest in February, I think his name was Dr. Parnia, that was talking about research about reviving. And so medicine is heading that way, and I believe that we'll be able to you know, in 10 or 15 years, perhaps, use a jumpstart mechanism to reactivate the human brain after long periods of freezing. So, and that's basically the last barrier to space travel through suspended animation.
What about propulsion, though, Robert?
So the thing about space is, because it's a vacuum, once you get that initial push from conventional rocket fuels, you can use the gravitational pull of planets to slingshot the spacecraft and not just maintain the motion, but increase it. So in space, once you get started, there's really no friction to slow you down. Now, there are dangers like asteroids and even smaller particles that can damage the spacecraft. So it's not, I'm not saying that space travel will be riskless. It will be very risky, but we'll be able to load people into crafts and send them on their way. Now, the suspended animation form of travel is probably not going to be the best way, because you still need a lot of shielding, not just to protect the ship from damage, but to protect the frozen bodies from radiation. And that's going to be expensive and and difficult to manufacture. I think there's going to be more efficient and less risky ways, and they'll rely on regenerative medicine. So imagine freezing stem cells of a person. Stem cells are cells that can change into any cell in your body, a brain cell, a skin cell, a red blood cell. And also imagine uploading not just your memories and your brain structure, but your DNA, your hair color, your eye color, your height, all the things that make you into a automated computer system that will use those stem cells, which will be frozen, to clone your body when the ship arrives at its destination. And so you could live your life here on Earth, send your stem cells in a cryonic state, which is actually easier to achieve now, and it's easier to protect because it's a small group of cells as opposed to a whole body. And you can send your digital information to replicate you in the future at the new planet. That's probably a much more feasible and economic approach. But again, the technical challenge is we don't yet have the ability to fully clone people in an automated fashion and then download the digital information about their brain, their memories, their personality into that new body. But there's technology emerging that will help us get there.
Robert, do you believe in life out there on other planets?
I think it is very highly probable that there is life on other planets. You know, because we look at advances in astronomy, and your prior guest had mentioned this as well. There's been an explosion of the number of planets that we've documented that are in the habitable zone. What's the habitable zone? It's the Goldilocks space where liquid water exists. And we believe that life needs liquid water to survive.
Mm-hmm. Not just to drink. Seems to be the soup to get life going, huh?
Yes, as life as we know it, anyway. And that we need water to drink. We can use water to make oxygen if the atmosphere is not suitable for breathing. And so that's what we're looking for as humans. But it's not necessarily the sole source of life. There could be alternative life forms that live in completely different environments. And we even see that here on Earth. There's microorganisms that live in volcanic vents on the seafloor. You know, there's an algae that lives in the steam pots in Yellowstone and in mines that are filled with acid and arsenic, you know, things that would kill life, you know, any human being. And these algae are growing fine in there. So if we think about the number of planets that we're discovering, and by the way, we're still not even able to see planets and all the different types of stars that are out there. We're still only looking at a small size, and we're not even considering the moons that orbit these planets, because the moons can also harbor life. So it is very highly likely that we'd have planets that can harbor life, and that we'll find a type of alien life. Now, what would it look like? Well, most likely it would be a single-celled organism like a bacteria or a virus, just because that's how life starts. And life is starting at different places at different times through the universe. And so when you look across the spectrum, you're more likely to see bacteria. That doesn't mean you can't find higher life forms and even intelligent life. We can find life that doesn't have the same type of living conditions that we do, a completely soil-dwelling organism or life form, for example.
Robert, with what has been going on this planet, in this universe, so many scientists are now talking about the multiverse theory, the fact that there could be other universes, which is bizarre to think about, but it's possible. Have you looked at that?
Yeah, it really is an interesting phenomenon, and the concept of space and time we're coming to realize is much more flexible than we first imagined. For example, there was a mathematician recently that was able to calculate that if you send two shock waves toward each other, that it wrinkles the fabric of space and time, which is a fascinating result. And actually, I could see, in the distant future where we're able to calculate how to send shock waves toward a spaceship so that it's able to make jumps across space and time, like in hyperspace. And once you start thinking that space and time can be twisted and manipulated, it really opens the door to this multiverse concept. And even thinking potentially about accessing alternative universes. And the big question then becomes, are these alternative universes parallel lives? Is there another Robert Harkin in a different universe doing something different at the same time?
Yep.
If I'm doing it? Or are they perpendicular? They have nothing to do with each other. And it's really, philosophically, it becomes a big challenge to reconcile your life with these multi-dimensional versions of you or alternative beings that live across dimensions. It's hard even to comprehend.
You have a passion for this. What keeps driving you?
So, technology has really fascinated me from a very young age. And I read a lot of science fiction when I was young. And I really enjoy it because it shows not just the future of technology, but science fiction brings out the human condition and how technology impacts that. And I really like to understand the human condition to better understand myself and others. And so I think there's, a great nexus there, where technology shapes us and we shape technology.
I happen to think that this planet is going through an incredible metamorphosis right now. People are acting weird. They're acting strange. There's like a cloud over people. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, there's been research that's been documenting some of the changes, and some of it's economically driven. If you look at the Financial Times reported, actually, I think it was in the Monday edition, that they looked at data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it showed that since 2007, 2 million clerical jobs have been lost in the U.S., but there's only been 387,000 manager jobs created to oversee the technology that replaced those clerical workers. So it's a net loss of clerical jobs. And the jobs that people are going to after they've left these clerical positions pay less. Since 2009, the median salary household salary has dropped by 5.6%. So we're seeing the impact, the negative economic impact of some of these technological changes. And it really changes a person when, you're doing a job that you enjoy and the rug is swept out from under you. And there's more and more change accelerating and you see it all around you. And This is what we call double exponential growth that technology creates, where the change increases at an ever faster rate. So it becomes overwhelming for individuals to try to deal with that that amount of change and to refocus and gain their balance in this new world. And that could be one of the factors that is causing this kind of global mind shift.
Of everything that you've developed and that you've been working on, what has fascinated you the most about this?
So for me, you know, understanding how people are changing how they live because of technology implications. You know,
we're adapting to this too, aren't we?
We are. You know, if you walk through any urban city, you know, during the lunch hour or the evening hour when people are leaving their offices, you know, most people walking down the street are looking at their cell phones. They're not looking up. They don't even look up when they cross the street. And it's amazing that they can cross the street without getting hit by a car because they never stop glancing at their phone. And that's really a behavioral change from in the past when you would make eye contact and you'd say hi. And you think about subtle things like if you tweet on Twitter and you write messages that are 120 characters long, well, then that message length was determined by a technical decision, you know, that the software programmers made that had nothing to do with communication. But yet it's changing our style of communication, making it much more shorter and abbreviated and harder to relate in the complex manner that we used to relate in person-to-person communication. So technology is changing us as we are changing technology, and there's not a concerted thought process about where things are going. You have, when you send out a tweet, you don't think, gee, how am I changing civilization with these 120 characters I'm sending out? No, you don't do that. And we can't expect a bunch of people individually driving blind in technology to find the right direction as a group. And so understanding where the direction is headed and where it needs to be headed is really quite fascinating for me.
Well, let me tell you something, Robert. I'm wondering if technology sometimes, though, has gotten too far. Life used to be simpler. I did a little experiment. I've asked people to keep their cell phone home for one day. I don't think anybody can do that. They're so accustomed to the phone, to sending a text message, jumping on the internet. I don't think people can get away from technology anymore. Do you?
It's very difficult, you know, and they've documented internet addiction. And that, you know, younger generations are growing up very connected. They're growing up with iPods and handheld video game consoles and cell phones, and their behavior is totally geared towards that. There was a research study that came out that showed people in their 20s are much more comfortable sending an instant message than walking down the hall and talking to someone face to face. And so it's really become, it's more than a crutch. It's a substitute for how people used to relate for generations and generations going back.
Oh, that's true. And I've got to tell you, Robert, if I had to talk on the phone to people who send me messages during the day, I'd never get anything done. It's just way too much. Well, stay with us, Robert. We've got another hour to go with you. We're going to open up the phone lines and allow everybody to chat with you about robotics, about machines taking over man, and about some of the things we've been talking about tonight. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.